Penguin Audio presents Polar Shift by Clive Cussler and Paul Kemprikos. Read by Scott Brick. Prologue. East Prussia, 1944. The Mercedes-Benz 770 W150 Grosser Turnwagen weighed more than 4 tons and was armored like a panzer. But the 7-passenger limousine seemed to float like a ghost over the cushion of new-fallen snow, gliding with unlit headlights past slumbering cornfields that sparkled in the blue light of the moon. As the car neared a darkened farmhouse that lay in a gentle hollow, the driver gently touched the brakes. The car slowed to the speed of a walk and approached the low-slung fieldstone structure with the stealth of a cat stalking a mouse. The driver gazed thoughtfully through the frosted windshield with eyes the color of Arctic ice. The building appeared to be abandoned, but he knew better than to take chances. White paint had been hastily slapped over the car's sculpted black steel body. The crude attempt at camouflage made the automobile practically invisible to the Stormovich ground attack planes that prowled the skies like angry hawks. But the Mercedes had barely escaped the Russian patrols that materialized out of the snow like wraiths. Rifle bullets had cratered the armor in a dozen places. So he waited. The man stretched out on the spacious back seat of the 4-door sedan had felt the car decelerate. He sat up and blinked the sleep out of his eyes. "What is it?" he asked, speaking German with a Hungarian accent. His voice was fuzzy from sleep. The driver hushed his passenger. "Something's not..." The rattle of gunfire shattered the glassy stillness of the night. The driver mashed the brake pedal. The massive vehicle hissed to a skidding stop about 50 yards from the farmhouse. He switched off the engine and snatched the 9mm Luger pistol from the front seat. His fingers tightened on the Luger's grip as a burly figure dressed in the olive uniform and fur hat of the Red Army staggered out the front door of the farmhouse. The soldier was clutching his arm and bellowing like a bee-stung bull. "Damn fascist whore!" he bawled repeatedly. His voice was hoarse with rage and pain. The Russian soldier had broken into the farmhouse only minutes before. The farm couple had been hiding in a closet, huddling under a blanket like children afraid of the dark. He had put a bullet in the husband and turned his attention to the woman, who had fled into the tiny kitchen. Shouldering his weapon, he had crooked his finger and crooned, "Frau, kommen," the soothing prelude to rape. The soldier's vodka-soaked brain failed to warn him that he was in danger. The farmer's wife hadn't begged for mercy or burst into tears like the other women he had raped and murdered. She had glared at him with hot eyes, whipped a carving knife out from behind her back, and slashed at his face. He had seen a flash of steel in the moonlight streaming through the windows and had thrown up his left arm to defend himself, but the sharp blade sliced through his sleeve and forearm. He punched her to the floor with his other hand. Even then she had lunged for the knife. Consumed with white-hot fury, he cut her in half with frenzied bursts of his PPS-43 machine gun. As he stood outside the farmhouse, the soldier examined his wound. The cut was not severe, and the blood flow was down to a trickle. He pulled a pint of homemade vodka from his pocket and drained the bottle. The fiery 100-proof liquor trickling down his throat helped numb the searing pain in his arm. He tossed the empty bottle into the snow, wiped his mouth with the back of his glove, and set off to rejoin his comrades. He would brag that he'd been wounded fighting a gang of fascists. The soldier trudged a few steps in the snow, only to stop as his sharp ears picked up the tick-tick sound of the car's engine cooling down. He squinted at the large grayish smudge in the moon shadows. A suspicious scowl appeared on his broad peasant face. He slipped his machine gun from his shoulder and brought it to bear on the vague object. His finger tightened on the trigger. 4 headlights blazed on. The powerful inline 8-cylinder engine roared into life and the car sprang forward, its rear end fishtailing in the snow. The Russian tried to dodge the oncoming vehicle. The corner of the heavy bumper caught his leg, and he was thrown to the side of the road. The car slid to a stop. The door opened, and the driver got out. The tall man walked through the snow to the soldier, his black leather overcoat slapping softly against his thighs. The man had a long face and a lantern jaw. His close-cropped blonde hair was uncovered even though the temperature was below zero. He squatted next to the stricken man. "Are you hurt, Tovarich?" he said in Russian. His voice was deep and resonant, and he spoke with the detached sympathy of a physician. The soldier groaned. He couldn't believe his bad luck. First that German bitch with the knife, now this. He cursed through spittle-covered lips. "Damn your mother. Of course I'm hurt." The tall man lit a cigarette and placed it between the Russian's lips. "Is there anyone in the farmhouse?" The soldier took a deep drag and exhaled through his nostrils. He assumed that the stranger was one of the political officers who infested the army like fleas. "Two fascists," the Russian said. "A man and a woman." The stranger went inside the farmhouse and emerged minutes later. "What happened?" he said, again kneeling by the soldier's side. "I shot the man. The fascist witch came after me with a knife." "Good work." He patted the Russian on the shoulder. "You're here alone." The soldier growled like a dog with his bone. "I don't share my loot or my women." "What is your unit?" "General Galitsky's 11th Guards Army," the soldier replied with pride in his voice. "You attacked Nemensdorf on the border." The soldier bared his bad teeth. "We nailed the fascists to their barns. Men, women, and children. You should have heard the fascist dogs scream for mercy." The tall man nodded. "Well done. I can take you to your comrades." "Where are they?" "Close by. Getting ready for another push west." The tall man gazed toward a distant line of trees. The rumble of huge T-34 battle tanks was like distant thunder. "Where are the Germans?" "The swine are running for their lives." The soldier puffed on the cigarette. "Long live Mother Russia." "Yes," the tall man said. "Long live Mother Russia." He reached into his overcoat, pulled out the Luger, and placed the muzzle against the soldier's temple. "Auf Wiedersehen, comrade." The pistol barked once. The stranger slid the smoking pistol into its holster and returned to the car. As he got behind the wheel, a hoarse cry came from the passenger in the back seat. "You killed that soldier in cold blood." The dark-haired man was in his mid-30s, and he had the handsome, chiseled face of an actor. A thin mustache adorned a sensitive mouth. But there was nothing delicate about the way his expressive gray eyes burned with anger. "I simply helped another Ivan sacrifice himself for the greater glory of Mother Russia," the driver said, speaking in German. "I understand this is war," the passenger said, his voice tight with emotion. "But even you must admit the Russians are human, like us." "Yes, Professor Kovach. We are very much alike. We have committed unspeakable atrocities against their people, and now they are taking their revenge." He described the horrors of the Nemensdorf massacre. "I'm sorry for those people," Kovach said in a subdued tone. "But the fact that the Russians behave like animals doesn't mean that the rest of the world must descend into savagery." The driver heaved a heavy sigh. "The front is beyond that ridge," he said. "You are welcome to discuss the goodness of mankind with your Russian friends. I won't stop you." The professor drew in on himself like an oyster. The driver glanced in the rearview mirror and chuckled to himself. "A wise decision." He lit a cigarette, bending low to shield the light from his match. "Let me explain the situation. The Red Army has crossed the border and blown through the German front as if it were made of fog. Nearly all the inhabitants of this lovely countryside have fled their homes and fields. Our valiant army has been fighting a rearguard action as it runs for its life. The Russians have a 10-to-1 advantage in men and arms, and they are cutting off all land routes west as they race toward Berlin. Millions of people are on the move to the coast, where the only escape is by sea.
God help us all, the professor said.
He seems to have evacuated East Prussia as well. Consider yourself a fortunate man, the driver said cheerfully. He backed the car up, threw the shift into low gear, and drove around the Russian's body. You are seeing history. The car headed west, entering the no-man's land between the advancing Russian juggernaut and the retreating Germans. The Mercedes flew along the roads, skirting deserted villages and farms. The frozen countryside was surreal, as if it had been tilted on its side and emptied of all human life. The travelers stopped only to refuel from the spare gas tanks the car carried in its trunk and to relieve themselves. Tracks began to appear in the snow. A short while later, the car caught up with the tail end of the retreat. The strategic withdrawal had become a full-fledged rout of army trucks and tanks that lumbered along through the falling snow in a slow-moving river of soldiers and refugees. The luckier refugees rode on tractors or horse-drawn carts. Others walked, pushing wheelbarrows piled with personal possessions through the snow. Many had escaped with only the clothes on their backs. The Mercedes rode up on the edge of the road, and its deep tire treads dug into the snow. The car kept moving until it passed the head of the retreat. Around dawn, the mud-splattered car limped into Gdynia like a wounded rhino seeking shelter in a thicket. The Germans had occupied Gdynia in 1939, expelled 50,000 Poles, and renamed the bustling seaport Gottenhofen, after the Goths. The harbor was transformed into a navy base, primarily for submarines. A branch of the Kiel shipyard was established to turn out new U-boats that were matched with crews trained in nearby waters and sent to sink Allied ships in the Atlantic. Under orders from Gross Admiral Karl Dönitz, an eclectic flotilla had been assembled at Gdynia in preparation for the evacuation. The fleet included some of the finest passenger liners in Germany, cargo ships, fishing boats, and private vessels. Dönitz wanted his submarine and other naval personnel rescued so they could continue to fight. Eventually, more than 2 million civilians and military personnel would be transported west. The Mercedes made its way through the city. A bitterly cold wind was blowing in from the Baltic Sea, whipping snowflakes into clouds of icy, stinging nettles. Despite the frostbite conditions, the city's streets were as crowded as on a summer's day. Refugees and prisoners of war slogged through deep drifts in futile search of shelter. Relief stations were overwhelmed with long lines of hungry refugees waiting for a crust of bread or a cup of hot soup. Wagons piled high with passengers and goods clogged the narrow streets. Refugees streamed from the train station to join the throngs who had arrived on foot. Muffled under layers of clothing, they resembled strange snow creatures. Children were pulled along on makeshift sleds. The car was capable of speeds reaching 170 kilometers per hour, but it soon became bogged down in traffic. The driver cursed and leaned on the horn. The heavy steel bumper failed to nudge the refugees out of the way. Frustrated at the glacial pace, the driver brought the car to a complete halt. He got out and opened the rear door. "Come, Professor," he said, rousting his passenger. "Time for a stroll." Abandoning the Mercedes in the middle of the street, the driver bulled his way through the crowd. He kept a firm hand on the professor's arm, yelled at people to make way, and shouldered them aside when they didn't move fast enough. Eventually, they made their way to the waterfront where more than 60,000 refugees had gathered, hoping to get aboard one of the vessels lined up at the piers or anchored in the harbor. "Take a good look," the driver said, surveying the sight with a grim smile. The religious scholars have been all wrong. You can plainly see that it is cold, not hot, in hell. The professor was convinced he was in the hands of a madman. Before Kovacs could reply, the driver had him in tow once more. They wove their way through a snow-covered settlement of tents fashioned from blankets and dodged scores of starving horses and dogs abandoned by their owners. Wagons cluttered the docks. Lines of stretchers carried wounded soldiers brought in from the east aboard ambulance trains. Armed guards stood at each gangway and turned away unauthorized passengers. The driver cut in front of a passenger line. The steel-helmeted sentry manning the checkpoint raised his rifle to bar the way. The driver waved a sheet of paper printed in heavy Gothic type under the sentry's nose. The guard read the document, snapped to attention, and pointed along the dock. The professor didn't move. He had been watching someone on board the ship anchored at the dock throw a bundle down to the crowd on the pier. The throw was short and the bundle fell into the water. A wailing went up from the crowd. "What's happening?" the professor said. The guard barely glanced in the direction of the commotion. "Refugees with a baby can get on board. They toss the baby back down and use it as a boarding pass over and over. Sometimes they miss and the baby goes in the water."
"How gruesome,"
the professor said with a shudder. The guard shrugged. "You'd better get moving. Once the snow stops, the Reds will send their planes to bomb and strafe. Good luck." He raised his rifle to bar the next person in line. The magic document got Kovacs and the driver past a pair of tough-looking SS officers who were looking for able-bodied men to press into duty on the front. They eventually reached a ramp leading onto a ferry crammed with wounded soldiers. The driver again showed his documents to a guard, who told them to hurry aboard. As the overloaded ferry left the dock, it was watched by a man wearing the uniform of the Naval Medical Corps. He had been helping to load the wounded on board, but he slipped through the mob and away from the waterfront to a maritime junkyard. He climbed onto a rotting derelict of a fishing boat and went below. He pulled a crank-operated radio from a galley cupboard, fired it up, and muttered a few sentences in Russian. He heard the reply against the crackle of static, replaced the radio, and headed back to the ferry dock. The ferry carrying Kovacs and his tall companion had come around to the seaward side of a vessel. The ship had been drawn several yards from the dock to keep desperate refugees from sneaking aboard. As the ferry passed under the ship's bow, the professor looked up. Printed in Gothic letters on the navy gray hull was the name Wilhelm Gustloff. A gangway was lowered and the wounded were carried aboard the ship. Then the other passengers scrambled up the gangway. They wore smiles of relief on their faces and prayers of thanks on their lips. The German fatherland was only a few days' cruise away. None of the happy passengers could have known that they had just boarded a floating tomb. Captain Third Class Sasha Marinescu peered through the periscope of the submarine S-13, his dark brow furrowed in a deep scowl. Nothing. Not a German transport in sight. The gray sea was as empty as the pockets of a sailor returning from shore leave. Not even a stinking rowboat to shoot at. The captain thought of the 12 unused torpedoes aboard the Soviet sub, and his anger festered like an open sore. Soviet naval headquarters had said that the Red Army offensive against Danzig would force a major sea evacuation. The S-13 was one of three Soviet subs ordered to wait for the expected exodus off Memel, a port still held by the Germans. When Marinescu learned that Memel had been captured, he called his officers together. He told them he had decided to head toward the Bay of Danzig, where the evacuation convoys were more likely to be found. Not one man objected. Officers and crew were well aware that the success of their mission could mean the difference between a hero's welcome and a one-way ticket to Siberia. Days earlier, the captain had run afoul of the secret police, the NKGB. He had left the base without permission. He was out whoring on January 2nd when orders had come down from Stalin for the subs to sail into the Baltic and wreak havoc among the convoys. But the captain was on a 3-day bender in the brothels and bars of the Finnish port of Turku. He returned to the S-13 a day after it was supposed to sail. The NKGB was waiting. They became even more suspicious when he said he could not remember the details of his drunken binge. Marinescu was a cocky and tough submarine skipper who had been awarded the orders of Lenin and the Red Banner. The swashbuckling submariner exploded in anger when the secret police accused him of spying and defection. His sympathetic commanding officer put off the decision on conducting a court-martial. That ploy fell apart when the Ukrainians who served aboard the sub signed a petition asking that their captain be allowed to rejoin his boat. The commander knew that this display of simple loyalty would be seen as potential mutiny. Hoping to defuse a dangerous situation, he ordered the sub to sea while a decision was made about a court-martial. Marinescu reasoned that if he sunk enough German shipping, he and his men might avoid being severely punished. Without telling naval headquarters of their plan, he and his men quietly put the S-13 on a course that would take it away from the patrol lanes and toward its fateful rendezvous with the German liner. Friedrich Petersen, the Gustloff's white-haired master captain, paced back and forth in the wardroom, sputtering like a walking pyrotechnics display. He stopped suddenly and shot a red-hot glare at a younger man dressed in the spit-and-polish uniform of the submarine division. "May I remind you, Commander Zahn, that I am the captain of this ship and responsible for guiding this vessel and all aboard to safety." Bringing his iron discipline to bear, Submarine Commander Wilhelm Zahn reached down and scratched behind the ear of Hassan, the big Alsatian dog at his side. "And may I remind you, Captain, that the Gustloff has been under my command as a submarine base ship since 1942. I am the senior naval officer aboard. Besides, you forget your oath not to command a ship at sea." Petersen had signed the agreement as a condition of his repatriation after being captured by the British. The oath was a formality because the British thought he was too old to be fit for service. At the age of 67, he knew his career was washed up no matter the outcome of the war. He was a Liger Kapitan, the sleeping captain of the Gustloff. But he took some comfort in the knowledge that the younger man had been withdrawn from active operations after he botched the sinking of the British ship Nelson. "Nonetheless, Captain, under your supervision, the Gustloff has never left the dock," he said. "A floating classroom and barracks anchored in one place is a far cry from a ship at sea. I have the highest regard for the submarine service, but you cannot argue that I am the only one qualified to take the vessel to sea." Petersen had commanded the liner once on a peacetime voyage and would never have been allowed to take the helm of the Gustloff under ordinary circumstances. Zahn bristled at the thought of being under the command of a civilian. German submariners considered themselves an elite group. "Still, I am the ranking military officer aboard. Perhaps you have noticed that we have anti-aircraft guns mounted on the deck," Zahn retorted. "This vessel is technically a warship." The captain replied with an indulgent smile. "An odd sort of warship. Perhaps you have noticed that we are carrying thousands of refugees, a mission more fitting of the merchant marine transport." "You neglected to mention the 1,500 submariners who must be evacuated so they can defend the Reich." "I would be glad to acquiesce to your wishes if you show me written orders to do so." Petersen knew perfectly well that in the confusion surrounding the evacuation, no orders existed. Zahn's complexion turned the color of a cooked beet. His opposition went beyond personal animosity. Zahn had serious doubts about Petersen's ability to run the ship with the inexperienced polyglot crew at his command. He wanted to call the captain a burned-out fool, but his stern discipline again took hold. He turned to the other officers, who had been witnessing the uncomfortable confrontation.
"This will be no strength through joy cruise," Zahn said. "All of us, Navy and Merchant Marine officers, have a difficult task and bear heavy responsibility. Our duty is to do everything possible to make things easier for the refugees, and I expect the crew to go out of their way to be helpful."
He clicked his heels and saluted Peterson, then strode from the wardroom, followed by his faithful Alsatian. The guard at the top of the gangway had glanced at the tall man's document and handed it to an officer supervising the boarding of the wounded. The officer took his time reading the letter. Finally, he said,
"Herr Koch thinks highly of you."
Eric Koch was the murderous Gauleiter who had refused to evacuate East Prussia while preparing his own escape on a ship carrying looted treasure.
"I like to think that I have earned his respect."
The officer hailed the ship's steward and explained the situation. The steward shrugged and led the way along the crowded promenade deck and then down three levels. He opened the door to a cabin that contained two bunks and a sink. The room was too small for the three of them to enter at the same time.
"Not exactly the Führer suite," the steward said, "but you're lucky to have it. The head is four doors down."
The tall man glanced around the cabin.
"This will do. Now, see if you can get us some food."
A flush came to the steward's cheeks. He was tired of being ordered about by VIPs traveling in relative comfort while ordinary mortals had to suffer. But something in the tall man's cold blue eyes warned him not to argue. He returned within 15 minutes with two bowls of hot vegetable soup and chunks of hard bread. The two men devoured their food in silence. The professor finished first and put his bowl aside. His eyes were glazed with exhaustion, but his mind was still alert.
"What is this ship?" he said.
The tall man scraped the bottom of his bowl with the last of his bread, then lit up a cigarette.
"Welcome to the Wilhelm Gustloff, the pride of Germany's Strength Through Joy movement."
The movement was an ongoing propaganda stunt to demonstrate the benefits of National Socialism to German workers. Kovach glanced around at the Spartan accommodations.
"I don't see much strength or joy." "Nonetheless, the Gustloff will again one day transport happy German laborers and party faithful to sunny Italy."
"I can hardly wait.
You haven't told me where we're going."
"Far beyond the reach of the Red Army. Your work is too important to fall into Russian hands. The Reich will take good care of you."
"It looks as if the Reich is having trouble taking care of its own people."
"A temporary setback."
"Your welfare is my utmost priority."
"I'm not concerned about my welfare."
Kovach hadn't seen his wife and young son for months. Only their infrequent letters had kept hope alive.
"Your family?"
The tall man regarded him with a steady gaze.
"Have no worry. This will soon be over. I suggest you get some sleep." "No, that's an order."
He stretched out on the bunk, hands clasped behind his head, and shut his eyes. Kovach was not deceived. His companion seldom slept and could snap fully awake at the slightest provocation.
Kovach examined the man's face. He could have been in his early 20s, although he looked older. He had the long head and craggy profile portrayed in propaganda posters as the Aryan ideal.
Kovach shuddered, remembering the cold-blooded way the Russian soldier had been dispatched. The past few days had been a blur. The tall man had arrived at the lab during a snowstorm and produced a document authorizing the release of Dr. Kovach. He had introduced himself only as Karl and told Kovach to gather his belongings. Then came the madcap dash across the frozen countryside and the narrow escapes from Russian patrols. Now this miserable ship.
The food had made Kovach drowsy. His eyelids drooped, and he drifted off into a deep sleep. While the professor slept, a squad of military police swept the Gustloff in search of deserters. The ship was cleared for departure, and a harbor pilot came aboard. At around 1 in the afternoon, the deckhands cast off the mooring lines. 4 tugs came alongside and began to pull the ship away from the dock. A fleet of small boats, loaded mostly with women and children, blocked the way. The ship stopped and took the refugees aboard. The Gustloff normally carried 1,465 passengers, served by a crew of 400. As it began this voyage, the once elegant liner was carrying 8,000 passengers. The ship headed into the open sea and dropped anchor late in the afternoon to rendezvous with another liner, the Hansa, to wait for their escorts. The Hansa had developed engine trouble and never showed up. Naval command was worried that the Gustloff would be exposed to danger in open waters and told the ship to go it alone. The liner plowed into the white-capped waters of the Baltic, fighting a stiff northwest wind. Hailstones rattled the windows of the bridge, where Commander Zahn seethed with anger as he looked down at the 2 so-called escorts that had been sent to protect the liner. The ship was built for southern climes, but with any luck, it could survive bad weather. What it could not survive was stupidity. Naval command had sent the liner into harm's way with an old torpedo boat called the Loa, or Lion, and the T-19, a worn-out torpedo recovery vessel, as escorts. Zahn was thinking that the situation could not get any worse when the T-19 radioed that it had developed a leak and was returning to the base. Zahn went to Captain Peterson and the other officers gathered in the bridge.
"In view of our escort situation, I suggest that we pursue a zigzag course at high speed," he said.
Peterson scoffed at the suggestion.
"Impossible. The Wilhelm Gustloff is a 24,000-ton ocean liner. We cannot go from one tack to the other like a drunken sailor."
"Then we must outrun any U-boats with our superior speed.
We can take the direct deep-water route at a full speed of 16 knots.
I know this ship.
Even without the bomb damage to the propeller casings, there would be no way we could reach and maintain 16 knots without blowing out our bearings," Peterson said.
Zahn could see the neck veins bulging in the captain's neck. He stared through the bridge windows at the old torpedo boat leading the way.
"In that case," he said in a voice that seemed to echo in a tomb, "God help us all." "Professor, wake up."
The voice was hard-edged, urgent.
Kovach opened his eyes and saw Carl bending over him. He sat up and rubbed his cheeks as if he could squeeze the sleep out of them.
"What's wrong?"
"I've been talking to people. My God, what a mess. There are 2 captains, and they fight all the time. Not enough lifeboats. The ship's engines are barely keeping us up to speed. The stupid submarine division ordered the ship to sail with an old torpedo boat escort that looks as if it was left over from the last war. The damned fools have got the ship's navigation lights on."
Kovach saw an uncharacteristic alarm in the marble features.
"How long have I slept?"
"It's nighttime. We are on the open sea."
Carl shoved a dark blue life jacket at Kovach and slipped into a similar jacket.
"Now what do we do?"
"Stay here. I want to check the lifeboat situation."
He tossed Kovach a pack of cigarettes.
"Be my guest." "I don't smoke."
Carl paused in the open doorway.
"Maybe it's time you did."
Then he was gone. Kovach spilled a cigarette from the pack and lit up. He had quit smoking years ago when he got married. He coughed as the smoke filled his lungs and he felt dizzy from the strong tobacco, but he recalled with delicious pleasure the innocent debauchery of his college days. He finished the cigarette, thought of lighting up another, but decided against it. He had not had a bath in days, and his body itched in a dozen places.
He washed his face in the sink and was drying his hands on a threadbare towel when there was a knock at the door.
"Professor Kovach," a muffled voice said.
"Yes?" The door opened, and the professor gasped. Standing in the doorway was the ugliest woman he had ever seen. She was more than 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders straining the seams of a black Persian lamb coat. Her wide mouth was painted in bright red lipstick, and with such heavily rouged lips, she looked like a circus clown.
"Pardon my appearance," she said in an unmistakably male voice. "This is not an easy ship to get aboard. I had to resort to this silly disguise and a few bribes."
"Who are you?"
"Not important. What is important is your name. You are Dr. Laszlo Kovach, the great German-Hungarian electrical genius."
Kovach grew wary.
"I am Laszlo Kovach. I consider myself to be Hungarian." "Splendid. You are the author of the paper on electromagnetism that electrified the scientific world."
Kovach's antenna quivered. The paper published in an obscure scientific journal had brought him to the attention of the Germans, who kidnapped him and his family. He said nothing.
"Never mind," the man said genially, the clown smile even broader. "I can see that I have the right man."
He reached under his fur coat and pulled out a pistol.
"I am sorry to be rude, Dr. Kovach, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to kill you."
"Kill me? Why? I don't even know you."
"But I know you. Or rather, my superiors in the NKGB know you. As soon as our glorious Red Army forces crossed the border, we sent a special squad to find you, but you had already left the lab."
"You're Russian?"
"Yes, of course. We would love to have you come and work for us. Had we been able to intercept you before you boarded the ship, you would be enjoying Soviet hospitality. But now I can't get you off the ship, and we can't let you and your work fall into German hands again."
"No, no. It just wouldn't do." The smile vanished. Kovach was too stunned to be afraid, even when the pistol came up and the muzzle pointed at his heart. Marinesco could hardly believe his good luck. He had been standing on the S-13's conning tower, oblivious to the freezing wind and spray that stung his face, when the snow cleared and he saw the enormous silhouette of an ocean liner. The liner appeared to be accompanied by a smaller boat. The submarine was riding on the surface in heavy seas. Its crew had been at battle stations since sighting the lights from boats moving against the coast. The captain had ordered the submarine's buoyancy reduced so that it would ride lower in the water and thus evade radar. Reasoning that the ships would never expect an attack from shore, he ordered his crew to bring the sub around the back of the convoy and run a course parallel to the liner and its escort. 2 hours later, Marinesco turned the S-13 toward his target. As it closed in on the port side of the liner, he gave the order to fire. In quick succession, three torpedoes left their bow tubes and streaked toward the unprotected hull of the liner. The door opened, and Carl stepped into the cabin. He had been outside, listening to the murmur of male voices. He was puzzled when he saw the woman standing with her back to him. He glanced at Kovach, still holding the towel, and he read the fear in the professor's face. The Russian felt the blast of cold air through the open door. He whirled and shot without aiming. Carl was a millisecond ahead of him. He had put his head down and rammed it into the Russian's midsection. The blow should have cracked the assassin's ribcage, but the heavy fur coat and the stiff corset he wore were like padded armor. The headbutt only knocked the wind out of him. He crashed into a bunk, landing on his side. His wig fell off to reveal short black hair. He got off another shot that nicked Carl's right shoulder muscle at the base of the neck. Carl lunged at the assassin and with his left hand groped for the throat. Blood from his wound spattered them both. The assassin brought his foot up and kicked Carl in the chest. He reeled back, tripped, and fell onto his back. Kovach grabbed the soup bowl from the sink and threw it at the assassin's face. The bowl bounced harmlessly off the man's cheekbone. He laughed.
I'll tend to you next.
He aimed a pistol at Carl.
Varum!
A muffled explosion thundered off the walls. The deck slanted at a sharp angle to starboard. Kovach was flung to his knees. Unused to the high-heeled boots on his feet, the assassin lost his balance. He fell on top of Carl, who grabbed the man's wrist, pulled it to his mouth, and sank his teeth into cartilage and muscle. The pistol clunked to the deck.
Varum! Varum!
The ship shuddered from two more massive explosions. The assassin tried to rise, but again lost his balance when the ship lurched to port. He teetered on the verge of standing. Carl kicked him in the ankle. The Russian let out an unladylike yell and crashed to the floor. His head came to rest against the metal base of the bunk. Carl braced himself against the sink pipes and drove his hobnail boot into the man's throat, crushing his larynx. The man flailed at Carl's leg. His eyes bulged. His face went dark red, then purple, and then he died. Carl staggered to his feet.
We've got to get out of here, he said. The ship's been torpedoed.
He muscled Kovach from the cabin into the passageway, where there was pandemonium. The corridor was filled with panic-stricken passengers. Their screams and shouts echoed off the walls. The ringing of alarm bells contributed to the din. The emergency lights were on, but a pall of smoke produced from the explosions made it difficult to see. The main stairway was clogged with an unmoving crush of panicked passengers. Many of them had stopped in their tracks as they gagged from the throat-burning fumes. The mob was trying to push against the river of water that spilled down the stairs. Kara opened an unmarked steel door, dragged Kovach into a dark space, and shut the door behind them. The professor felt his hand being guided to the rung of a ladder.
Climb, Kara ordered.
Kovach dumbly obeyed, ascending until his head hit a hatch. Carl shouted from below to open the hatch cover and to keep climbing. They went up a second ladder. Kovach pushed another cover open. Cold air and wind-driven snowflakes lashed his face. He climbed through the hatch and helped Carl into the open. Kovach looked around in bewilderment.
Where are we?
On the boat deck. This way.
The icy, sloping deck was eerily quiet compared to the horror in the third-class section. The few people they saw were the privileged passengers whose cabins were on the boat deck. Some were clustered around a motorized pinnace, a sturdy boat built to cruise in the Norwegian fjords. Crew members had been chipping away with hammers and axes at the ice on the davits. With the davit fastenings finally freed, the crewmen surged aboard, pushing aside women, some of them pregnant. Children and wounded soldiers didn't have a chance. Carl drew his pistol and fired a warning shot in the air. The crewmen hesitated, but only for a second, before they continued to fight their way onto the lifeboat. Carl fired another shot, killing the first crewman who had climbed into the boat. The others ran for their lives. Carl lifted a woman and her baby into the boat, then gave the professor a hand before climbing in himself. He allowed some crewmen aboard so they could throw the dead man out and lower the boat to the water. The hooks attached to the lowering lines were unfastened and the motor started. The heavily burdened boat wallowed as it moved slowly across the sea toward distant lights from a freighter that was headed their way. Carl ordered the lifeboat stopped to pick up people floating in the water. Soon it became even more dangerously overloaded. One of the crewmen protested.
"There's no room in the boat," he yelled.
Carl shot him between the eyes.
"There's room now," he said,
and ordered the other crewman to toss the body overboard. Satisfied that the short-lived mutiny was under control, he squeezed next to Kovach.
"You're well, Professor?"
I'm fine.
He stared at Carl.
You're a surprising man.
I try to be.
Never let your enemies know what to expect.
I'm not talking about that. I saw you help the wounded and women. You cradled that baby as if it were your own.
Things are not always what they seem, my friend. He reached into his coat and brought out a packet wrapped in a waterproof rubber pouch.
Take these papers.
You are no longer Laszlo Kovács, but a German national who has lived in Hungary. You have only a slight accent and will easily pass. I want you to disappear into the crowd. Become another refugee. Make your way towards the British and American lines.
Who are you?
A friend.
Why should I believe that?
As I said, things are not always what they seem. I am part of a circle that has been fighting the Nazi animals long before the Russians.
Light dawned in the professor's eyes.
The Kreisau Circle?
He had heard rumors of the secretive opposition group.
Karl brought his finger to his lips.
We are still in enemy territory, he said with a lowered voice.
Kovács clutched Karl's arm.
Can you get my family to safety as well?
I am afraid it is too late for that.
Your family is no more.
But the letters?
They were clever forgeries, so that you would not lose heart and give up your work.
Kovács stared into the night with a stunned expression on his face. Karl grabbed the professor by the lapel and whispered in his ear,
You must forget your work for your own good and the welfare of mankind. We cannot risk that it will fall into the wrong hands.
The professor nodded dumbly. The boat banged up against the freighter's hull. A ladder was lowered. Karl ordered the reluctant crewmen to take the boat out again to pick up more survivors. From the freighter's deck, Kovács watched the boat push off. Karl gave one last wave and the boat disappeared behind a veil of falling snow. In the distance, Kovács saw the lights of the liner which had turned onto its port side so that the funnel was parallel to the sea. The boiler exploded as the ship slipped below the surface about an hour after being torpedoed. In that short time, five times more lives were lost on the Gustloff than on the Titanic.